You're listening to Voice Actor Showcase, episode number 2. Hi everyone, and welcome back to Voice Actor Showcase, a podcast about voice actors and their stories. I'm Jun Yoon. Welcome to episode 2. The Voice Actor Showcase is about voice actors on their journey to realize the dream of becoming an established voice actor. We're interested in telling the stories of countless voice actors around the world who are working hard to get there. Whether that means they've taken their first step yesterday, or they're on the verge of letting go of their other job to dive in with both feet. Now, just as before, I'd like to stress the fact that the voice actors being featured on this podcast are paid for their work. At the current time, I can only manage $50 for a payment, but I promise and promise and promise to increase the pay for their work and effort as my earning potential gets bigger. I promise. If you have an interesting story to tell, and you have not made a six-figure salary as a voice actor last year, I'd love to have you on the show. Please contact us by visiting voiceactorshowcase.com. Today, we'll meet a voice actor from Sandwich, New Hampshire. Born and raised in Alaska, he first had his taste of stage acting at age 16. Since then, he's performed numerous characters on many stages in Alaska, New Hampshire, Dublin, Ireland, and New York. He's most known for his work on the audiobooks The Jupiter Man by Nick Dorsey and A Short Walk to the Other Side by Matthew Palmieri. We can also look forward to hearing his narration in the upcoming audiobook Nothing by Matthew Palmieri, which will be released on Audible very, very soon. Now, I'm going to make a little edit point here and insert the following sentence. Now, he's a very busy voice actor, a stage actor, and a person with a full-time job. So instead of a live session where we could have a live conversation, I've sent him a list of questions and asked him to record his answers. Performing a monologue from Kept Men by Richard Lay, please welcome Ethan Fifield.
There's nothing as beautiful as killing somebody you don't know. You know they done something wrong and deserve to be put down. But they never tell the hitman what his victim did to offend. It's important to me that the person doesn't look me in the eye. He might plead for his life. And if I ever thought twice about it, he might kill me. Oh, don't get me wrong. When I'm not working, I'm a nice person. I give to panhandlers, and I help blind people cross the road. After a whack, I like to go to Joey's Diner and have a plate of eggs and hash, smothered with ketchup. I always leave the gun at the scene. It shows disrespect for the guys in homicide. 'Cause when they check out the gun, it's one of their own. They don't investigate too hard after that. Polly says I have a sense of humor. I wouldn't say that, but anyone who is the best at what they do has a little pride and an ego that needs to be fed by a little self-induced jocularity.
So you're kind of like me. We both come from the theater world, and we instantly recognize the importance of actor training in order to be successful in voice work, right? In addition to being able to portray a character, right? What other aspect of training and working as a stage actor has helped in voice acting?
Well, surprise, surprise, a lot of the most useful aspects have still come out of the voice training that I've had. Breath control and diction have been huge things for me and really important to the work that I've done. A lot of what I've done so far is audiobooks, and when you run into a particularly long sentence or whatnot, it's important to know how to keep yourself going to and through the end of the sentence and to hit each word crisply and cleanly. Script analysis training has also been really nice. As an audiobook narrator, it just helps to be able to know how to break down the story and figure out the general direction things are taking and how that impacts your narration. My theater experience is also where I got my first taste of working with audio software, actually, and learned to start editing my own work, which has been a huge boon for me. It's a skill I'm still developing, of course, but that's where I got my first experience with it.
So, studying theater has taken you to some really interesting places. What are some of those memorable experiences that you got, and what are some of the lessons you learned from those universities, schools, professors, and so on?
That is a very long list. Like you said, I've been fortunate to study theater in a lot of different places, and I have had so many amazing experiences doing that. Just to take a few, one of the biggest moments for me came out of the training that I had in Plymouth, New Hampshire, when I finally figured out how to shift my voice between different vocal resonators. I'd been told when I was training up in Fairbanks that I needed to learn how to move my voice out of my head and throat, but I'd never really grasped what that meant until I started engaging with Linklater technique in Plymouth. And that's where I first got a sense of how to move my voice around between different registers, just to drive it out of my throat and maybe down into my chest or stomach or up into the very top of my head, so I can achieve a very different vocal quality without really having to strain. And of course, when you go and learn to mix this with dialects, it just gets even more fun to try to, you know, hit all of these different places. I do apologize for, you know, playing around with it, but it's just... it's so much fun, you know? When you get started, you can't really help it. And it's a really useful tool for distinguishing between characters. Obviously, it's not the only thing you want to rely on, but especially in audiobook narration, having that wealth of options as to what to do with your voice is really useful when you want to differentiate between different characters. It's not, of course, the only way to do it, but I do have a lot of fun with it. In Ireland, I learned the incredible power that stillness can have on stage, and just how crucial it is for you to control your movement so that it doesn't take away from the scene that you're trying to use it to add to. It's a lesson that's been really useful for voiceover as well as stage, because when you're recording, unnecessary movement can translate into unwanted noise on the recording. And from experience, unfortunately, I can confirm that trying to edit chair creaks out of a recording, especially when it's right behind the audio itself, is an absolute pain. My time in New York drove home to me just how much a scene can gain when you go at it with the most, well, for lack of a better word, human objective you can, when you find a way for your character to really deeply care about the other involved in the scene. It's also where I had some of my more significant voiceover training, like specifically geared voiceover training, and where I got my first taste of audiobooks. One of the big lessons I remember from that training is that vocal quality, just like the nature of your voice, is not the only thing that you need for narration or voiceover. It's also important, like with anything else, to find your into it and really actively engage with it in a way that's going to make other people want to listen. When you're doing audiobooks, for instance, it helps to imagine that you're reading a book to somebody, because, well, that is what you're doing, just with a microphone and possibly a few thousand miles in between you and that person. But, you know, you're telling somebody a story, and it's not enough that your voice sound good. You've got to be actively engaged with that story in order to pull them in and keep them listening and make them want to know what happens next. And honestly, that kind of helped sell me on the idea of audiobook narration even more as something to pursue, because that's what I'm in the performing arts for. I love telling stories. So that just really seemed like the way to go, especially after that. And for Fairbanks, well, that's the first place that I studied, where I first got my feet underneath me as an actor and finally admitted to myself that this is what I want to do with my life. And I'm really grateful for the teachers who helped me through that process. The one lesson that I really remember the most from my time there is something that one of my instructors, Brian Cook, said to me. He warned me ahead of time that this was not going to be an easy career path, that there'd come times in my life when nobody, myself included, was going to believe in me. And those were the times when it was most important to put my nose to the grindstone and carry on. I have definitely been in that place that he described, and I can only imagine there will come a time when I'm there again. And just knowing that that is something we all have to go through and that it can be overcome was a really huge boon to me and helped me keep going through points in my life when it felt like there was no light at the end of the tunnel.
Thanks to your experience as an actor, I think, you know your archetypes really well. Now, tell us about your experience about discovering your archetypes and how it helps in the audition process for both stage and voice work.
Well, my archetype's something that I kind of figured out in retrospect, and with a bit of input from my friends and the people that I've worked with. I've done enough roles to have a career to look back on at this point, and looking back at them, I find the characters that I get cast as tend to be serious, earnest, and more often than not, pretty eccentric. They're totally devoted to what it is that they do, never mind that the thing they're doing and or the process might not really make any sense. In fact, they seem to be more devoted the less sense it makes. It even goes beyond the stage sometimes. I've been told before that I put people in mind of a mad scientist. So I've got some idea of what my type is and what I can most naturally and easily bring to a production. I can use that to help me pick the projects I audition for. That's not to say it's the only thing that guides what I go after, but it definitely helps me out when I'm determining what sort of projects to pursue. It doesn't always come up as much with my audiobook work because there's a lot of characters to portray, but it really helps me to get into a character when I can find somebody who fits this kind of mold. I've had a few scripts where I've been able to spot this sort of archetype, and the characters that have come out of it have been some of my favorites to play.
Now, you're an active working stage actor, right? While working as a maintenance person and handling voice work on top of all of that, how do you manage the balance between your job, the theater productions that you're in, and the voice work?
With some difficulty, honestly. And as far in advance as I possibly can. Generally speaking, what I end up doing is doing voiceover work during the day, whether that means recording or editing or auditioning for new projects, and then working a closing maintenance shift at night. Live theater work is the most irregular element of the three, but as long as I get my schedule in advance, I can make it work pretty well. My maintenance job is flexible enough that my shifts can move around as long as I let them know well ahead of time where I've got conflicts. So if I get my schedule for a theater production ahead of time, I can pretty easily reconcile live theater rehearsal and performance with my maintenance work.
Honestly, okay? Which is more difficult, stage acting or voice acting, and why?
I'm gonna go with stage acting here. Couple of reasons. First off is that, personally, I struggle a bit with developing a character's physicality. I love digging into a text and looking at the character, really getting inside their head and picking apart what makes them tick on the inside. But it's a bit harder to translate that into, you know, how they move, how they carry themselves, and, you know, how they rest, for lack of a better word, when they're not actively engaged in some pursuit on stage. The other thing, of course, is that live theater is a different show every time. Even when you're doing the same script, night to night, little things change that can take a scene in a very different direction and add some new wrinkle, and you've got to be ready to roll with that. Though, honestly, that one's as much of a complicating factor as a pure delight.
Now, let's talk about some of your voice work. You're listed as the narrator on a number of audiobooks. For you, what is the recording experience like? Describe your experience on recording audiobooks for, you know, the aspiring and current audiobook narrators that are on ACX and other platforms that are listening to this podcast.
Sure. So my audiobook work up to this point has been through ACX.com, which you mentioned. The first step in that process is, of course, the audition. ACX has got a variety of projects posted at all times. I'll go on, find something that I want to audition for, record the sample, and send my audition off to the rights holder. If they like it, they'll send an offer I can accept, and at that point, I'll get the manuscript and the real work starts. First thing I do is read through the book cover to cover. Get a sense of what the story is, where it's going, what the arcs for all the characters are, what the through line of the plot is, so on and so forth, just, you know, making notes of how everything changes and what that'll do to my narration over time. Then I sit down to record the audiobook. This'll be a chapter at a time, or however it's organized, front to back, usually over the course of a few days, because it does get to be a lengthy process. There's no editing at this point, not a lot of stop and start, it's just start and go. If I flub a line or section, I'll pause, take a breath, get it out of my system, go back to where I messed up, and start over. And do it right this time, or, you know, keep going back and keep doing it until I've got it right. Once everything's been recorded, that's when the editing starts. I'll go back over my files and edit out the flubs and any mispronunciations. I'll clean up the audio and get it in a presentable final draft sort of condition. And this is the part that takes me the longest because I listen through every chapter and really pore over everything. The words, the spaces in between, just listening for whatever needs fixing. It can take a few days, usually. Often significantly more than the recording itself. So once I've got everything in a final draft sort of condition and I'm satisfied with it, I'll upload the files to ACX and let the rights holder know that they're ready for review. And then usually the rights holder reviews it, and if they find anything that I might have missed or that they'd like changed, they send it back to me, I make the changes, send it back to them. And this'll go back and forth until both parties are satisfied with the whole thing. At which point, the project gets reviewed by ACX itself. And of course, you know, if they find any problems, they'll kick it back to me. I'll fix it, get it submitted, we'll go through the whole deal again. Once all the proper changes have been made and approved by all parties, the book's up and available for sale on Audible, Amazon, and iTunes. And that is the process.
You've narrated Nick Dorsey's The Jupiter Man, where we find the main antagonist, the Frozen Avenger. Now, especially because you're not a supervillain in real life, I think. Now, I would think there'd be more than a few challenges here about finding this character and telling his story. What was your process in portraying the Frozen Avenger, and how do you maintain that characterization throughout the book?
I mean, if I were a supervillain, it's not the sort of thing I'm likely to announce, is it? Unless, of course, I knew no one would believe me. But anyway, to answer your question, I should probably clarify that the Frozen Avenger is not the main antagonist of the Jupiter Man, though he definitely spent some time in that category. He's actually our protagonist's former employer. Our protagonist, Zach Hernandez, is a small-time crook trying to go straight, and the Frozen Avenger is the mastermind behind his one last job, which turns out to be way bigger than either of them anticipate and kicks off the story in earnest. As far as representing who the Frozen Avenger is, he's a bit eccentric, but he's a human like anybody else. So, this was just part of reading the book through the first time. I made notes of, you know, what he said and did and what people said about him, tried to figure out what it was he cared about and how he goes about things. And I have to say, he's probably one of my favorite characters that I've narrated. There is a lot of stuff going on with him. And he fits into the category of characters I mentioned before, who are totally serious about and devoted to something that may not make a whole lot of sense. When we first meet him, he's pretty ridiculous looking. He's a domineering man in an over-designed suit of power armor with a penchant for dramatic monologues and a burning desire to see Pluto return to planet status. And all of that is completely true of him, but there's a lot more to him that starts to show up as we go through the book. He is really bright and philosophical, a very intelligent person, at times disarmingly so. Sometimes he even ends up giving Zach advice that turns out to work pretty well. And while the job that kicks off the book goes south fast, it's clearly not the Frozen Avenger's first rodeo. He's got a certain savvy to him and a long list of contacts that comes from having been a supervillain for a fair amount of time. For all that his goals can be pretty ridiculous, he goes about them in a very intelligent manner. He knows when to hold them, knows when to fold them, just as long as the Astronomical Society isn't involved. So for the most part, as I brought the character through the book, I tried to keep in mind the seriousness, dignity, and professionalism that he brings to his agenda, at least in his own head. He's a person with goals that he's powerfully devoted to, even when they only make sense to him. And to top it all off, he has got a pretty distinctive voice to work with. It's described early in the book as being rather high-pitched, with a country twang that the man can't quite hide. And so kind of a fun exercise as I was working on the characterization was to try to picture the Frozen Avenger's voice, and give it both that ridiculous aspect,
and the sort of intelligence and gravity that I believe it deserves, given the character's own nature as a criminal mastermind.
Let's talk about your stage work, too. Certainly, you enjoyed the yellow stockings and the garters that Malvolio has to wear in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, right? tell us more about your experience in acting with Shakespearean text.
I did love playing Malvolio. It was a lot of fun. Whether or not you think he gets what he deserves, there is no denying he goes through a lot of terrible stuff. But as far as the text goes, I really enjoy working with Shakespeare because there is so much to dig into with it. The main spot I find where it differentiates from using a more modern text is in the amount of prep work you do beforehand, or rather, where that prep work's focused. You are, to some small degree, dealing with a different language. It looks a lot like English. I mean, okay, it is, but it's structured slightly differently, and there's a few words and cultural expressions and references that didn't necessarily make the jump all the way forward to our own time. So when I'm going over a Shakespeare text for the first time, I also tend to have another book or a computer sitting out in front of me so that I can look up whatever it is that I don't understand and just figure out exactly what it is that I'm saying. Once I've got that, you know, I'll, just for my own benefit, write out what it is that I'm saying in more modern language, as I might say it if I were going to today. That helps me nail down the meaning a little better, and once I know what I'm saying and what I'm trying to get across, memorizing the text itself isn't really any different or more difficult than memorizing a modern text. And that whole process serves a couple purposes. First, of course, you know, helping me to understand what I'm saying. And once I've got a good grasp on that and can properly deliver it, that helps me to support my fellow actors on stage and to carry the meaning across to the audience that I'm interacting with, which is actually another really fun part of my experience with Shakespeare. So I work a lot with a particular company called Advice to the Players, and a big part of how they produce Shakespeare is to try to involve the audience. So when there's a soliloquy or a long argument that the character is involved in, we're encouraged to kind of engage with the audience at appropriate points and, you know, try to pull them in, talk straight to them, if you will, and share with them, in Shakespeare's words, what we're going through as that character. So probably my favorite scene with Malvolio that comes out of that is the scene in the garden where he discovers Olivia's letter and starts reading it aloud and going through it and getting steadily more excited because, oh my word, my lady's in love with me. And he gets to share that excitement with the audience, and they all know he's being played for a fool. But it is just so much fun in that moment to talk with them and share with them all of these things that Malvolio's suddenly starting to realize line up and point to the fact that his lady is in love with him, which we know, of course, she's not. But the energy in that moment and feeding off of the audience and, you know, believing for a moment that they're excited for the same reasons I am as Malvolio is just so much fun. Like I said before, it's my favorite part of playing that character.
And out of all the characters on the stage that you've portrayed, right, which character have you enjoyed playing the most? Tell us about that.
Oh, this is another one of those too many options questions. It's hard to pick. I've had a lot of fun roles, and, you know, as part of portraying a character, you have to find your in and a way to connect with them. And most of the time, you really come to love them through that. I think if I was going to pick one I've done recently, just to try to make this more doable, I'm sorry, I'd have to say Antonio, once again from Twelfth Night. And he's probably my favorite character that I've played, in large part just because I like who the guy is. He's brave, loyal, generous, he wears his heart on his sleeve, and he's not afraid to go to bat for the people that he loves. And kind of branching off of that, part of going to bat for the people he loves involves getting into a sword fight for the sake of the sister of the man he loves, who's disguised as a man and happens to look really similar to her brother. And that's just a fun experience because not a lot of the roles that I've been involved in have given me much opportunity for stage combat. And as Antonio, I got to have a brief sword fight, which was something I really enjoyed.
How did you go from Alaska to New Hampshire? Tell us a bit more about the move across the country here.
To be completely honest with you, it's not really my proudest moment. I was born and raised in Alaska, but my family moved out this way to be closer to the larger branch of the family that lives in New England. And at the point in my life where I followed them, I had completely lost all sense of direction. I was struggling to figure out what I was going to do next. And I followed because I needed to be closer to family and that sort of emotional support system while I figured out what my next step was. And obviously, it's a bit different here than it is in Alaska. Population size is a big thing. There's a lot more people in even the sparsely populated areas around here. I grew up in a village of less than 1,000 people, and it's still smaller than the small town I live in at present. I think the biggest thing that I had to get used to living down here was just the idea that you can drive anywhere, even into other states. It was a big change going from an island where getting out of state or even to a major city involves, at the very least, a 3-hour ferry ride, and then most likely a few plane trips, to an environment where you can just get in your car and, you know, drive to Florida should the situation demand it.
Are you married? Have kids? What do family or friends or your kids think about you being a voice actor?
I'm unmarried, with no kids in the picture. The closest family I have is my parents, my brother and his wife, and of course the cat that we jointly raise. And I've been fortunate in a lot of ways, but I feel like this is where I lucked out the hardest because they're really supportive of the work that I'm trying to do as a voice actor. I'm the first person in the family who's tried to pursue this, to my knowledge anyway, and they've always got a lot of questions to ask me. They're curious about the whole process, and they're always excited to hear what I'm doing next. And that's honestly surprising to me a lot of the time, because going to voiceover was a big jump. There was a point in my life, before I realized what I wanted to do, when I was studying biology. And they took that transition in total stride. I think my dad, in particular, kind of called that it was going to happen. And even during the periods in my life where I've struggled to believe in me and what I'm doing, they never have. They have been incredibly supportive, and it's hard to put into words what that means to me. My extended family's been pretty awesome as well. I've got an aunt and uncle who were absolutely thrilled to find out I was going into voiceover, and a younger cousin who's into theater herself and who asks me every time we run into each other what my latest project is. The cat, on the other hand, is not supportive. She is very affectionate and wonders why on earth I would choose to shut myself up for hours with recording equipment when I could be playing with her. But, you know, how do you explain voiceover work to a cat? Seriously, if you have any ideas, that would be hilarious.
What is one thing you didn't know about the voice industry that you wish you'd known before jumping into this?
I'm not sure if it's the industry exactly, but having worked as my own editor as well as a narrator, I have learned just how lengthy and complicated the editing process can be, and I really wish I'd come into voiceover with a better understanding of it. I'm always working to correct that. I read books on audio mastering, I look for answers online, but I really wish I had come into this with a more solid understanding of that particular set of tools. Still, nothing to do for it now but work to correct it, right?
Now, to a certain extent, the equipment that we use for voice work and the equipment that we upgrade to is a pretty interesting mile marker of our progress in this industry. What equipment do you currently use and what did you start out with?
Truth be told, I'm still using a lot of what I started with. I record using a Bluebird microphone, a Focusrite audio interface, and the Audacity software, which I also use to edit with. I just recently picked up a second microphone, a Yeti USB mic, which I'm really excited about because in the first place, it's a lot more portable than my current setup, And in the second, it is just a jump forward of a few years in regards to technology. I've had a few opportunities to test out its audio quality, and I'm really liking it thus far.
Any thoughts of moving to LA or New York in the future?
You know, I never thought I would want to, but yes, absolutely. Like I mentioned before, I was lucky enough to be able to study in New York for a while, and I would love to go back there. It was kind of a culture shock at first, being in that big a place, but once I got through my initial panic, I absolutely fell in love. There's a huge artistic community there, and I'd love to go back and get involved in it. I've got no real experience with LA, but if I found an opportunity to go and work there, I'd take it.
What are your goals for 2020? Personal and professional.
They kind of bleed together, really. My grand ambition, of course, is to become more and more a professional artist, to get to the point where this is what I do for a living, completely. And so the next step for me there, I think, is improving my online presence. I need to get a website up. I need to update my existing online presence with my most recent samples. I just need to sit down and take care of this element of the job, which can be hard to do sometimes with all the balls that I'm juggling at the moment, but which absolutely does need to happen. On a purely personal note, I'd like to find time to write more. A lot of my favorite work is science fiction and fantasy. Those are the stories that I loved growing up, and frankly, even now, that's the stuff I have the most fun narrating, and it's the sort of thing that my mind occasionally wanders to. I've got a few story ideas in my head, things that still need a lot of refinement at this point, but that refinement never happens if you don't write it down and get it out there and start sharing it with people. And hey, if I get some really good stories together, I can narrate them myself and put them out there for other people to enjoy. That is entirely self-made work right there. Definitely something to aim for.
So what's next? What do you have coming up, and where do you go from here? Also, if the people that are listening want to find you and learn more about you, where do they go?
Well, in the near future, I've got another audiobook coming out soon. It's another work by Matthew Palomary that I've narrated, and it's called Nothing. It's a sci-fi thriller about computer-generated dreaming technology, the people who develop and test it, and the human drama that unfolds as different groups of them attempt to bend that technology toward different ends. And on a more local note, I don't know if anybody listening happens to be in the New England area, but if they are, I'm excited to be working with Advice to the Players again on an upcoming production of The Winter's Tale. And we're going to be performing that in late March, so it's something I am really excited to be doing. More Shakespeare, always nice. For anybody listening who may want to find me, I am currently online on acx.com and voice123.com. By the end of the year, I hope to have expanded that list of addresses.
This has been Voice Actor Showcase. Visit our website at voiceactorshowcase.com. If you'd like to be featured on this podcast, contact us at voiceactorshowcase.com. Thanks for listening.